We're looking at the home, 15 passages that talk about that, which will be with this hour. Then we want to look at truth in Proverbs, and there are four concepts coming out of that. And then you have the phrase 12 times in Proverbs that such and such a thing, quote, is an abomination to the Lord. And we are in our study now to God responding to the home, and we're looking at Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 7, where we stopped last hour, Proverbs 12, 7. Keeping in mind now that God not only responds to individuals, but God responds to entities also. God also responds not only to people as individual people, but God responds to a certain home life. And what we're looking at today is the way we conduct ourselves in our home. Whatever the size may be, God is going to respond to it. And we had our first passage, which was Proverbs 3:33 this morning, and now we're ready for chapter 12 and verse 7. It says, "The wicked are overthrown and are no more, but the house or the home of the righteous will stand." So notice the key idea in this proverb is the idea of stability versus instability. The idea is stability versus instability. And the emphasis is that the home of the righteous has a permanency built into it as over against the wicked, which are said to be no more. Now, when it says in verse 7 that the wicked are overthrown and are no more, what does it mean when it says no more? What is the idea of no more? The idea involved in no more is the idea they have no resiliency, there is no bounce back, or no power of recovery. When disaster strikes, they're down. And the reason there is no real power of recovery other than just human ability is very simple. They do not know the Lord. And the emphasis is that the house of the righteous have a relationship to God, and consequently there's something inherent. The Holy Spirit is resident in them, and there is ability to bounce back and to recover. We ought to emphasize also, and by the way, this is not teaching when it says the wicked are no more, some kind of fatalism. Simply because those who are wicked can become righteous. They can come to know the Lord, and therefore power of recovery would be available. Keep your finger here, but look at 10:25 where you've got the same idea. That in the time of calamity, the believer has a built-in resiliency that is not present with the unbeliever. Chapter 10, verse 25 says, "When the whirlwind passes, the wicked is no more." No power of resiliency, no bounce back. And therefore, you have the idea that is throughout Proverbs that all evil is inherently unstable. All evil is inherently unstable. There is something about it that is not permanent. Keeping your finger here again, but going to chapter 12. Well, we're in chapter 12, verse 3, going back to verse 3. Notice that there is no ultimate stability in evil. It says a man, verse 3, will not be established by wickedness. There is nothing inherently permanent in it. But the root of the righteous will not be moved. Now, there is one other thing we ought to note. There is nothing here to indicate that the wicked have any less trouble in life than the righteous. He is not promising that if you are righteous, you will have less pressure than the wicked will. He's simply saying, under the pressures, you'll be able to respond differently. And so you have the same amount of problems with the righteous as you do with the unrighteous. The point is, there is an ability to bounce back, and therefore resiliency is part of it. So, when the righteous stumble, they get up. When the righteous stumble, they recover. Or could we put it in boxing terms? The unrighteous go down for the count. The righteous are forever getting decked, but they always get up. Let me show you one passage that makes that so very clear, and that is in Proverbs 24 and verse 16. It's a very realistic passage. I think it's one of my favorites. I like it because it's realistic. It doesn't say that if you live for the Lord, you'll never get decked. It says if you're righteous, you're forever getting decked. But you always bounce back. chapter 24, verse 16. Very well put. It says, "For the righteous man falls seven times." The idea of seven is the idea of completeness. And the idea is he is forever on his back. He is always stumbling. But what is his characteristic? He rises again. And so the idea is here is this righteous man, and it seems like he is forever getting hit with a problem. And he goes down, and you turn around, and he's on his feet again. And no more does he get on his feet, but something else hits him, and down he goes. And you turn around, and what happens? He's on his feet again. That is the characteristic of the righteous and the just man, is they have the ability to recover and the ability to bounce back. And therefore, in the Christian experience, coming out of Proverbs 24:16, don't feel bad because you stumbled. Feel bad because you didn't get up. And that's the characteristic. Go to 2 Corinthians 11. You got a good example of a man who was forever getting decked, but he always got up. 2 Corinthians 11, 23. And notice Paul is relating how many times he went down. But Paul was always on his feet. He never went down for the count. Chapter 11, verse 23, he says, "Are they the servants of Christ? I speak as if insane. I more so, in far more labors, in far more imprisonments, beaten times without number, often in danger of death." When Paul got beaten, what did he do? He quit. He said, "I resign my apostleship." No, he didn't. He got on his feet again. Verse 24, "Five times I received from the Jews 39 lashes." And what did he do after every time? He got up again. "Three times I was beaten." And after each time he was beaten, what did he do? He got on his feet again. "Once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day have I spent in the deep. I have been on frequent journeys, in dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers in the sea, dangers among false brethren. I have been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights." And what did he do after a sleepless night? Quit? No, Paul went on. He rebounded. And so forth. It's hunger and thirst, often without food, cold and exposure. Apart from such external things, there is the daily pressure upon me of concern for all the churches, and so forth. But notice Paul as he writes, where is he? He's on his feet. And so let's go back to the proverb then, chapter 12, verse 7. God's response to the home of the righteous. "The wicked are overthrown and are no more. They do not rebound. But the house of the righteous, or the home of the righteous, will stand." Righteousness has an effect on our home life. It's very interesting that the stability of the home is due to what? The moral character of the people in the home. All right, our next proverb dealing with it is Proverbs 14 and verse 11. Proverbs 14 and verse 11. And the first thing I'd like for us to notice in Proverbs 14:11 is notice the contrast in the dwelling places of these two people. And as you notice the contrast in it, we want to ask a question, but let's read it first. Proverbs 14:11. "The house of the wicked will be destroyed, but the tent of the upright will flourish." And the first thing there to note is that the unrighteous have a house, and the righteous have a tent. This is the righteous man's dwelling, and this is the unrighteous man's dwelling. Now, looking at those two things from the physical standpoint, if you wanted to withstand the assaults of the weather, and if you wanted to have protection from the elements, which is obviously the object of a residence, which would you pick, the house or the tent? Which one, just looking at the thing itself, which one is the stable one? Obviously, the house is the stable one, the one that will give you protection. And the tent is the one that can be taken away with the wind. It's the unstable one. So that logically looking, you want to go to the place that is physically the best environment for protection. But notice the irony of chapter 14 and verse 11. What happens? The house of the wicked will be, and where would you put the word destroyed? Under the tent or under the house? I would put it under the tent, wouldn't you? And say that the tent gets destroyed and the house stands. But notice it's just the opposite. The house of the wicked will be destroyed. And on the other hand, in verse 11, the tent of the upright will flourish. And I'll put that word flourish down because we want to do a little work with it because it's a very colorful one. So you want to say to the author of Proverbs, hey, you got it wrong. You've had the stable house falling and you've had the unstable one standing and growing. No, what is the difference? Why does he do that? What is the difference between the two? Very simple. This one has a moral quality in this home that the other one does not. It's simply saying moral quality in the home is stronger than brick. The house cannot be made strong enough to overcome the devastation of unrighteousness. So you have an interesting twist in this particular verse with these two. Now, I said I want to do something with the word flourish. And when we make reference to the original language, it is for the purpose of clarification. And here I want to do it with that word flourish because it's such a colorful word. The first thing about the word flourish is it's a hyphal stem. And we have numerous times been over the fact that in the Hebrew language they use stems such as kal, statement of fact, pael, strong statement of fact, and hyphal, which means, do you remember? It means somebody has caused something, the idea of cause. So verse 14 reads, the tent of the upright will be caused to flourish. And so the idea would be, who is doing the causing? Well, obviously God is the cause behind it. God causes blessing. And God causes blessing because this is his child and this is his children. The second thing about the word flourish dealing with the house of the righteous is it is an imperfect. And I don't want to say imperfect tense because Hebrew doesn't have tense. It has states. And it has only two in the whole language. That is the perfect state and the imperfect state. The perfect state means it's finished. The imperfect means it's going on. So the idea of the imperfect state is a continuous action. God is continuously blessing and continuously causing the house of the righteous to flourish. And then the third thing is to say something about the stem itself. And again, since we have some who are working with Hebrew, you may want to pick up some vocabulary from here. So I'll give you the stem looking like that. Para. And it is a stem that means to bud, to sprout, to blossom. It's a word used in connection with a plant. And so he's simply saying in verse 11 that the righteous home experiences what kind of blessing? Well, the righteous home is just like a rosebud. Every time I look at it, it's budding. And the emphasis is it's in a continually budding state. Rosebuds obviously do not bud forever. They bud and then flower out and then they die. But this idea is this home is forever like a bud that you get up this morning and it's sprouted again. And what is the cause of this? The cause from the divine standpoint is the blessing of God. And from the human standpoint, this is a home of a person who is righteous in right relationship to the Lord. All right? Our next passage, or E in our outline, is Proverbs 15:25. Chapter 14, the home of the righteous is like 1,000 springtimes. Multiple springtimes within a year. And now chapter 15 and verse 25. It says, the Lord will tear down the house of the proud. He will establish the boundary of the widow. And so first of all, we have something said about the home of the proud. And we want to do a little work with the word proud. What does that mean? The home of the pride. Or, we ought to ask the question, why is this, or why is pride so terrible? In the book of Proverbs, pride is one of the most horrible things. And why is it that pride is so bad? What makes it such a sin? Why would God react to a household of pride with destruction? What is so terrible about it? Well, the essence, what is the essence of pride? Just think about, how would you summarize pride? Isn't pride primarily focus on self? Isn't that basically what pride is? Pride refuses to look at the needs of, the interests of anybody except myself. And therefore, it is essentially a self-centered thing. What is the word we use for someone that is self-centered? What is the word in Greek for self? Ego. And a person who is proud is what? Egotistical. And that word very much defines what pride is. It's simply saying it is ego-centered. It is centered on self. Well, still, what is so bad about that? Well, the thing that makes that so bad is that it violates the whole principle of Proverbs. Or it violates the motto. What was the motto verse? Chapter 1 and verse 7. Respect for the authority of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And therefore, is the egotistical person the person that is going to say, I submit to the authority of the Lord? Is the proud person the person that's going to say, my righteousness can never bring me salvation, it is only the righteousness of Christ, and I surrender all of my goodness in order to gain His salvation? Will a proud person do that? Will an egotistical person do that? An egotistical person basically has to give up his ego to become a Christian. Because the first announcement of salvation is you can't do it. There is no amount of works that you can produce that will gain your salvation. You've got to surrender all of your goodness. And that, in essence, is saying, I am nothing. And consequently, you have the strong idea here of the evil of pride. A second thing about it is it's so terrible because it focuses on man, not on God, and therefore violates the motto of Proverbs. But there's a second thing about it that is important, is that pride is at odds with three entities. Pride is at odds with, number one, is found in chapter 8, verse 36. Pride is at odds, number one, with one's own self. Proverbs 8, 35 and 36. Pride is at odds with one's own self. Chapter 8, verse 35 and 36. Verse 35 says, he who finds me finds life. This is wisdom speaking. He who finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who sins against me injures himself. In this verse, we really need to... The Hebrew is very colorful. In verse 35, it begins with the words, my finder. And in verse 36, it begins with the words, my misser. And so he's talking about his finder and his misser. And what he is saying is, the proud have a real problem with their finder and their misser. Their finder is confused, and their misser is confused from the standpoint that their finder is forever finding the wrong thing, and their misser is forever missing the right thing. And notice the way we have that stated in verse 35. The one whose finder is correct finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who sins, and the word sins means to miss, he who misses against me injures himself, and those who hate me love death. So, pride is to be at odds with oneself. Second, pride is to be at odds with one's neighbors. Wrong inwardly, and now wrong outwardly. Proud person is wrong with his neighbors, and for that, Proverbs 13 and verse 10. Proverbs 13, 10. Unfortunately, a New American Standard Version has taken the word presumption and replaced it with the word, with the Hebrew word for pride. So verse 10, it says, through pride. Does King James have pride, or does it have... You got pride, okay, that's better, because that is the right word. Through pride, of course, presumption is pride, but nonetheless, through pride comes nothing but strife. And the strife obviously involves your relationship with other people. And so through pride comes nothing but strife, but with those who receive counsel is wisdom. So to be proud is to be at odds with oneself, it is to be at odds with one's neighbors, and it is finally, and worst of all, to be at odds with God. Chapter 16 and verse 5. And we will have this as part of our study tonight. This is one of the 12 passages in the book of Proverbs that talk about things that are an abomination to the Lord. And here is one of them. Everyone who is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. All right, now back to our proverb. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 25. Now, in verse 25, let's ask one other question in order to explain the verse. When the verse reads as follows, "The Lord will tear down the house of the proud." Question, is he doing this because of the man's attitude or because the man has done something, or both? And I would opt for both, that the proud man here has done something. And I would argue that from two standpoints. Can you see in verse 25 what he might have done? See anything, any concrete sin he might have done? He apparently has taken away the property of a defenseless person, has he not? Because the latter part says, he will establish the boundary of the widow. And the idea is the widow, as a defenseless person, has had her property lost. And it has been lost, apparently, to this proud person. You have him mentioned once again in chapter 16 and verse 19, just across the page. This proud man has been out plundering people. And verse 19 says, it's better to be of humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. So the proud has been out plundering, as you can see, obviously. And therefore, that fits in with the context of verse 25. Also, coming back to the 25th verse, in the Old Testament, the widow is the ultimate example of poverty. It is the person without earthly protection. Now, that's not necessarily true today, because very often a widow is quite well off because her husband has perhaps worked for many, many years and has good insurance policies. And when he dies, she is usually in pretty good condition. Not true in biblical times, and certainly not true in the Old Testament. Whenever you see the widow, you're looking at a person who is defenseless and a person who is apt to be attacked. It is interesting, is it not, that in verse 25, who takes up the cause of the defenseless? Notice in verse 25, it is God who takes up the cause of those who cannot protect themselves. All right, there are four passages then that talk about the home under curse and under blessing. And now we're ready for the home, its disorders. The home, its disorders. And our first passage under the disorders in the home will be Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 29. We're now going to look at the fact that there can be some very definite order, disorders in the home. Chapter 11, verse 29. It says, "He who troubles his own home will inherit wind, and the foolish will be servant of the wise-hearted." Now, basically, verse 29 picks up a thought that started back in verse 17. In verse 17, you had the idea that the merciful man does himself good, but the true man does himself harm. And therefore, you come down to verse 29 that emphasizes that thought more. He who troubles his own house will inherit wind. Notice, let's put it very simply. The deed affects the doer most. Think about that. The deed affects the doer most. That's exactly what he's saying. What you do relative to the home is going to affect you the most. And apply that in many areas. But the next time we do something or are tempted to do something that is contrary to God's will, remind yourself, this deed that I'm about to do will affect me most. No one else, only me. And this is the principle that is involved here. How about mental attitudes? What about worry? Does the deed of worry, if we can call worry a deed, who does it affect most? Nobody but you. Are you really peeved at someone? You almost hate them? Who does it hurt the most? Only you. You're the one that lives with the hatred. You're the one that lives with the worry. And therefore, this is true in deeds and mental attitudes as well. The one that does it is the one that is often most affected by it, and that's an important lesson. And that's true in this verse. He who troubles his own house will inherit wind. To trouble is simply a word that means to unsettle. So the idea is he unsettles his house. And we don't even need to go into the meaning of that word, unsettles his house, because there's no one here that doesn't know how to do it. You know how to go home and unsettle things? Anyone who does not know. Have any idea how you can unsettle your wife and children? And if you're a child, you have any idea how to unsettle a household this afternoon? Can you sit down at the meal and guarantee upsetting the whole household? Do you know what to say? How to say it? When to say it? And so forth. We're all experts at that. So the idea, and notice whenever we unsettle a house, we get a rich reward from it, don't we? What's the reward of unsettling your house in Proverbs chapter 11, verse 29? A rich inheritance of what? Wind. Delicious, delectable wind. Wind, inevitably, in the Old Testament, is used for anything totally devoid of substance. Put that down. Wind, in the Old Testament, is used for anything that is totally devoid of substance. It has none. There's nothing to it. Ecclesiastes uses that so often. Solomon says in his pursuit of things other than God, it was like eating wind, eating nothing. And again, you can see the value of sitting down at lunch today to an appetizer of wind, followed by a main course of wind done rare, followed by a wind souffle. Wind moose. So the emphasis then in verse 29 is if you unsettle your own house, you will inherit wind. Now, I think the author of Proverbs who knew the Old Testament, when he used that verb for unsettled, I can't resist. He knew the Hebrew language, he knew the Old Testament, and he must have thought of that verb that was applied in a very special place in the Old Testament. And for that, let's go back to the man that did it to the whole nation. Here, unsettling is applied to the house. But Solomon probably remembered the event in the history of Israel when one man did it to the whole nation. Do you know his name? Go back to Joshua chapter 7. For the man who did this, the same verb, did it to the whole nation. And we'll see how he did it and thus know what it means to unsettle a house. Joshua chapter 7, verse 25 and 26. The man who unsettled the nation, this same word, was named Achan. Achan unsettled the whole nation of Israel. And remember what he had done. In battle, he had taken some of the loot and hid it in his tent, and as a result, the whole nation got defeated. Very interesting principle. One man sinned, and God responded to the whole nation. And in the passages we're looking at this morning, the way one man in the family can respond can bring a response of God to the whole family. Chapter 7, verse 25. Joshua said to Achan, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day, and all Israel stoned him with stones, and they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. And they raised over him a great heap of stones that stands to this day." And the verb that we've got is, "Why have you troubled us?" is the same one that we have had translated in Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 29 as troubles or unsettled. So what had Achan done then in unsettling the people? He had unsettled by disobedience to God's word. So we have one concrete case of unsettling the nation. And how did he do it? By a disobedience to the Lord. And I take it then, coming back to Proverbs chapter 11, how can this man upset his house? He can do so by being disobedient to the Lord. All right, our next passage. The home, its disorders. Number one, we may unsettle it by disobedience to the Word. B. Our next passage, Proverbs chapter 15 and verse 27. Now notice this verse is talking about how your mental attitude toward material things affects the home. So we'll put MA, mental attitude toward the material things affects the home. Attitude toward material things affects the home. Reading it, verse 27. It says, he who profits illicitly troubles or upsets his own home, but he who hates bribes will live. Several things about that. The word profit illicitly is to get your material things or your material gain in an illegitimate way. And therefore, we need to ask a question. What is the difference between legitimate profit motive and greed? Let's put them both down. Profit motive. Do you have any profit motive? I hope so. If you're not, I'm sure your business is not doing very well. And if you're a salesman, you ought to be fired. Because what do you work for, basically? The glory? You just appreciate the boss saying thank you. Job well done. Now you're out there and you're working to make money. That should be the reason that a business is operating, to make money. That's profit motive. That's legitimate. How do you distinguish that from greed? What is the difference between greed and profit motive? It's an important thing for a believer to understand what the difference is. And I think we can give three guidelines. Number one, when I bend rules of honesty. That's our key. When I bend rules of honesty, I am greedy. When I bend rules of honesty, I am greedy. For example, look at Leviticus chapter 19, verse 36, where God gives for the Jewish businessman some definite rules, and they're not to be bent. Profit motive says, I'll do everything I can to make the money, but I won't bend the rules. That's legitimate. When that profit motive goes over and says, I'll do everything I can to make money, including breaking the rules, that's greed. Leviticus 19 and verse 36. Speaking to the businessman who is weighing out his product, it says, you shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah. That was a measurement. If you've got a footnote there, I think you've got down below ephah, do you not, in a New American, about one bushel. Oh, speaking of bushels, it reminded me of an announcement I forgot to make. If the walnuts off the tree out here are good. I mean, they're work, but they're good. And for the last trimming of the lawn for the year, Joel, I think you said he had, what, a bushel? Okay, that are there. If you want them, see Bob Grimes. Bob, raise your hand. That's the nut man. You know, it is funny to watch the how much the crazy squirrels out here. I never really caught it till this year. I stand here the day occasionally and watch them. And they are picky. You ever notice that? They'll pick up a nut like that and they'll look at it and throw it down. Go and get another one and examine it, take a bite out of it and throw it down. And then finally they settle on one. And I wanted to say, you picky squirrel, you're leaving us with all the kernels and you're picking up the good ones. I don't know what they do. They taste or what? Does anyone know what there is? But they sure are. They're particular. They know a good nut when they see one. Animals are interesting. I had a professor at Dallas Seminary saying about it when he went hunting once up somewhere north, that he was sitting there waiting for deer. And he said, as he was sitting there, he said a bear came out from the woods. And he watched the bear. He said it went over, and it started scooping up all the leaves and got all of the leaves in a nice big pile. And then it climbed up in the tree and started jumping off into the leaves repeatedly. Okay, 1936. All that triggered by one word here, word bushel. You shall have just balance, adjust weights, adjust bushel, adjust hen, that's about a gallon. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Notice that the justice and the fairness in business is because of God. He's not saying honesty is the best policy. He's saying you be honest because of me. And that's all the way through, that the honesty on the part of a believer is not because you'll do better business, though you probably would. The emphasis is, this is what honors God. So what is one of the lines we can draw between legitimate profit motive and greed is when we begin to bend the rules of honesty, then we are in the area of greed. Second guideline is when we hurt others. Bend rules when I injure others. And that does not mark out competition, though. I'm sure that if you run a good business and the man across the street who does not goes out of business, he's been hurt. But that's not your fault. That's his fault. I'm talking about taking a course of action that purposely and intently wants to injure. And when we do that, we are in the wrong area. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 27, the verse we're at, talks about that particular type thing. Or profits a little. A third thing is we're in the area of greed when it overrules the priority of life, overrules the priorities of life. And this one is easily done, is that we are so involved in making money that the children grow up and they don't know our name. And that, of course, is taking a priority of life that is very, very important and setting it in a secondary place. And this is a thing, if you're not occupied in the business world yet, that you ought to consider. There is a reality of life whereby you can get so high in the corporate ladder, and if you're to get any higher, you're going to have to give up wife, family, and everything else to get it, probably. And that's something to think about, is that very often the desire for the higher position and the money is going to be very costly in terms of the family, because you're going to be at the office all of the time. And you're going to be working all of the time, and therefore some of those priorities, especially with children, get lost, and the children are lost, and you have your position and you have your good job, except the children don't know you, and not only do they not know you, but they really don't care to know you. Okay, now that deals then with the some of the disorders in the home. One other passage. Oh, no, we didn't finish out that verse, really. Chapter 15, verse 25. No, we're not at 15:25. We're at 15:27. He who profits illicitly unsettles his own house, his own home. But he who hates bribes will live. Now, let me say something about the word bribes. The word bribes is an absolutely, totally innocent word. It's nothing more than the Hebrew word for a gift. So he who hates gifts will live. And being a neutral word for a gift is simply noticing the fact that gifts can have great purchasing power. Realistically, how many contracts do you think were bought this week with a gift to the right person at the right time and the right place? It's a reality of the business world, and he is simply saying that gifts have great purchasing power, and those that can sense that I'm being given a gift in order to buy me should avoid that at all costs. All right, Proverbs 21 and verse 9. There are two of these. Deal with the home. Proverbs 21 and verse 9. two passages, they're the same, so I'll simply list them together here. Proverbs 21:9, 25:24 talks about the home that you don't want to be in. 21:9, it is better to live in the corner of a roof than in a home shared with a contentious woman. Remember when we talked about that word contentious, we gave several synonyms to it. A synonym for the word contentious is to create an argument, the word argument, to create a quarrel, to create a conflict, to create a dispute. So under the idea of contention, you've got all of those that are synonymous. And notice in Proverbs 21:9, you're looking at someone who is called a contentious woman. And as we've said before in Proverbs, just because a man deceives once, he is not a deceiver. Just because a man lies once, he is not a liar. And just because a person or a woman causes a quarrel in the home, that does not make her a contentious woman. The labels placed on people in Proverbs are labels placed there because that is the very bent of your whole disposition. This is what you're like. And so this woman here is not one who occasionally does this. This is one who is forever causing arguments in the home. And notice also in connection with that, that the quarrels in verse 9 are not public, they're private. They all happen in the home. Is there any disparity often between your public image and what goes on at home? Boy, everything goes on in the front room, doesn't it? Probably one of the most revealing places of Christian character is the home. And consequently, we build walls around ourselves so that we will be able to pull down the curtains and no one will know about the home life, and we can all do very well when we're in public because we can all maintain an image. But notice this is going right into the home and saying, I would be a bit surprised if this woman here wasn't one of the most gracious people that you could ever meet in public. But she's a hellion in the house. And this is what's the idea. The same thing can be true for men, obviously, but he happens to have here women also in view. So notice again, very, very telling type proverb. You hardly want to comment on it. Notice also, not only is it public, but it's apparently with her husband, because it's the one who lives with her that goes through all of this. And then notice also it is a proverb of comparison. Better to live in the attic than downstairs with one who is forever quarrelsome. Notice one other thing. All sins have their built-in penalty, cause and effect. What is the penalty of being quarrelsome? Nobody wants to live with you. Lack of companionship, and that's nice, isn't it? Got the kind of disposition that nobody wants to be in the same room with you. And so notice it has its own little built-in kind of penalty, and therefore in the home, she ought to be, by all means, a peacemaker. Let's be an argument solver, a quarrel eliminator. Be a quarrel eliminator. Let's all get together and eliminate the quarrels. They're on the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 row. Bob and Evie quarrels. Okay, next. Proverbs 27, verse 8. Now, we happen to live in a day when if you can't get along in a home, you just leave, you split. This verse is talking about and apparently saying a woman who may be in a very, very difficult home life. And in 27:8, you have the following picture. It says, like a bird that wanders from her nest. Do you see any consistency in the translation here? So is a man. That's interesting. Like a bird wanders from her nest, so a man wanders from his home. I take it that the man here is in generic sense and probably referring to a woman in this passage. So like a bird that wanders from her nest, so is one, a woman, who wanders from her home. And the emphasis, therefore, is on the mother. And therefore, it is simply saying about the disaster of do not desert maternal responsibility. Do not desert maternal responsibility. It's important. Don't desert it. And this is simply like a bird pictured here that has her nest, and apparently her young are in the nest, or the eggs are in the nest, and she goes off and leaves her home. Her home is her her nest. We're going to have, and we won't get to that now, I see, until this evening, we're going to have also a title that is going to come around for a woman. It's back in chapter Proverbs 14 and verse 1. Let's close with it. I bring it in because we're here with the woman. It says, a wise woman builds her home, but the foolish tears it down with her own hands. And the only thing I want to pick up with here at this particular moment is I hear a lot of women say, I don't want to be called a housewife. I'm not married to a house. And I agree. I think that's very cold. What is the biblical term for you? Housewife? How about taking it off of Proverbs 14 and verse 1? You are a home builder. That is the legitimate title from the standpoint of God's Word. She is to be a home builder, not a housewife. And we'll pick up with that Roman numeral number 3 tonight, which will be the home, its prosperity. At its disorders, now its prosperity. And then we'll go on to truth, and then on to closing out the evening with a series of abominations. Our Father, we're thankful today for your word. We recognize from it the tremendous importance of the home. May we recognize that through disobedience to your will, we can unsettle the home with all of the consequences that go with it. And yet, on the other hand, we can have a home that is blessed if we'll simply remember that above all relationships, the relationship to you is most important. And therefore, may we establish that, may we nourish it, may we maintain it, in order that our homes might be, as you could put it, flourishing, as they might be budding, that our home might be a picture of 1,000 springtimes within a year, because the blessing of the Lord is there. For we ask this in Christ's name.